a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m., our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews, and culture pieces from across Aotearoa Dunedin.
Kia ora and welcome to R1 News. You're listening to Radio 1 91 FM. Happy Thursday. Today we've got some great headlines and interviews up for you, so keep tuned.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday the 30th of May. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Jonah. Over the last 3 days, Israel has carried out 2 airstrikes on Palestinian tent cities in and near Rafah that were designated safe zones for thousands of Palestinian civilians displaced by the war. On Monday, an Israeli airstrike in western Rafah killed 45 Palestinians, 23 of these being women, children, and elderly. And yesterday, another Israeli airstrike killed 21 Palestinians in the Al-Mawasi area of Rafah, with another 64 wounded, and 10 of these being in critical condition. These numbers are reported by the Palestinian health officials and Palestinian civil defense to Al Jazeera. Monday's Israeli airstrike was carried out at night and triggered fires that ripped through the camps for the displaced, burning tents and makeshift shelters. The Palestine Red Crescent Society, a humanitarian organization, says many who died were burned alive inside their tents, while Gaza's civil defense reports of charred bodies. The Israeli airstrike has been condemned. The Palestinian presidency has called it a, quote, heinous massacre, and has accused Israeli forces of deliberately targeting the tents of displaced people. Countries that have put out statements condemning Israel's attack include Qatar, Egypt, Turkey, Spain, Ireland, and Norway. Both airstrikes happened after the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to halt its offensive and withdraw from Rafah last week as part of South Africa's case made against the court accusing Israel of genocide. Of Monday's airstrike, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it targeted a Hamas compound in a precise strike and was aware of reports of civilian harm and that it was a, quote, tragic mistake, unquote, and says they will investigate the incident. Of yesterday's airstrike, Israel denied their military strike the humanitarian area in Al-Mawasi.
In national news, Gisborne's mayor believes that Gisborne is an outlier to the Mouldy Wards bill and should not have to follow the new proposed legislation. Zeta Campbell of One News reports. Earlier this week, we ran a story about the Mouldy Wards proposed bill change as a whole. However, this story has since developed due to Gisborne's mayor, Rahit Schultz. Schultz was among numerous council mayors and chairs throughout Aotearoa that have signed a letter criticising the government's proposed bill on Mouldy Wards. Stoltz revealed that she signed this letter on behalf of the Gisborne District Council because they have followed the proper democratic process when creating their own Mouldy Ward. She was quoted saying, "We have seen a beautiful contribution around the table from our Mouldy Ward councillors," unquote. The government's proposed bill will give councils that establish Mouldy Wards after 2021 the choice to reverse that decision or have a binding referendum during their next elections. This letter was coordinated by Local Government New Zealand, stating that the bill was an overreach on local decision-making. When speaking to Local Democracy Reporting, Stoltz explained that Gisborne and 9 other councils are outliers to the reasoning behind the proposed bill. She told them that her council undertook extensive community consultation and had public hearings on whether to introduce Mouldy Wards in 2020. Quote, "The consultation on Mouldy Wards received 293 responses, the largest number of submissions compared to previous engagements. Of these, 68.4% saw value in establishing Mouldy Wards, and 67.6% confirmed their desire to see them established," unquote. After all this work, Stoltz's council notified the public of its decision and provided an opportunity for electors to demand a referendum. However, according to Stoltz, no such demand was received. Following a representation review, which included Mouldy Wards, councillors voted to introduce them for the 2022 and 2025 local body elections. These processes overlapped with the previous government's legislative changes, which meant binding polls could not force Mouldy Ward referendums. Quote, "Gisborne District Council and 9 other councils are in a position where we did follow the proper process," unquote, Stoltz stated. Stoltz said introducing a referendum with the next elections would cost the council $7,500 plus GST. ACT MP Todd Stevenson has announced he will sell all his shareholdings to remove all distractions, One News reports. This announcement follows recent concerns about the ACT MP Todd Stevenson's investments in pharmaceutical companies and how this may affect his ability to do his job. Stevenson is a parliamentary private secretary to Associate Minister of Health David Seymour, who is also responsible for Pharmac. Pharmac is the company from which New Zealand receives and purchases medicines. Before becoming an MP, Stevenson worked for multinational healthcare companies overseas. This would not be of any concern. However, recently, Seymour has met with representatives from three pharmaceutical companies, two of these being linked with Stevenson in some way. The first of these companies is Vertex Pharmaceuticals, which Stevenson is a former employee of and was also in attendance during the meeting. And the second is Johnson & Johnson, which Stevenson currently has shares in. However, he did not attend this meeting. Seymour told the Herald that Stevenson had no role in setting up these meetings and in publicly declared his investments. Last week, Labour Party Deputy Carmel Cipollone accused Stevenson of being a, quote, pharmaceutical industry plant whilst in Parliament. On Tuesday, Stevenson released a statement dismissing this comment, quoting, "Any suggestion that I've done anything other than use my experience to assist in making better public policy is completely baseless. There is no conflict between my declared shareholdings and the work I've been doing to support David Seymour as the Associate Health Minister," unquote. When talking about the purpose of his role as Private Secretary, he stated it was to, quote, "build relationships with relevant communities, represent the Prime Minister, represent the Minister at public events, and assist with administrative matters," unquote. Stevenson claimed that Cipollone's comments shows that she doesn't understand how PharmAc operated. Stevenson has announced that he will not allow anything to distract from the government's goal of delivering real change in the critical area of medicines access. And to do this, he has, quote, "decided to divest all my shareholdings as reported in the Pecuniary Interest Register to ensure no distractions exist," unquote.
In Otipoti news, the death of 16-year-old Anere McLaren Tan at Dunedin's bus hub last week has resulted in the establishment of a new multi-agency group to improve the safety of the bus hub. This Monday, Dunedin Mayor Jules Radich met with representatives from the Dunedin City Council, the Otago Regional Council and police, and agreed to establish the new group. The new group's terms of referencing are currently being drafted, with the Dunedin City Council saying that the group will seek to represent, quote, "schools, bus users and the wider community." Mr. Radich said that last week's tragedy sent shockwaves throughout the community, and that the establishment of the new bus hub agency group, quote, "is an important step focusing on changing behaviour at the bus hub. Bus stop B remains closed until further notice as a mark of respect." Last Friday, the mayor attended a blessing at the bus hub and added flowers to the tribute for the young man, which features flowers and written messages of love and condolences. Mr. Radich encouraged the community to come together in their grief. Otago Regional Council Chair Gretchen Robertson said in a media release that "our thoughts and deepest sympathies go out to the family and all those impacted following this tragedy." He continued to, quote, "urge people to have confidence in the safety of the bus system." Two Otago politics lecturers, Dr. Peter Grace and Professor Robert Patman, have co-edited a new book on Jacinda Ardern's foreign policy. The book, titled "New Zealand's Foreign Policy under the Jacinda Ardern Government, Facing the Challenge of a Disrupted World," is an edited volume featuring chapters from various authors sharing their perspectives on the book's topic. In a piece published on Newsroom last Wednesday, the two academics discuss how Ardern's global popularity resulted in New Zealand's international profile growing significantly, while the country also faced significant challenges. They note that Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has had less of an international impact, which can be seen in comparing the media coverage between the two leaders. The book's description says that Ardern's foreign policy took place in the context of, quote, "the COVID-19 pandemic intersected with an evolving and often tumultuous post-Cold War global environment." Much of the book focuses on the pandemic and how it intersected on different aspects of New Zealand's foreign policy, including geopolitics, economics, climate, and security. The book's description says that Ardern's distinct foreign policy, quote, "drew on the success of its handling of the pandemic as well as Aotearoa New Zealand's indigenous values and emphasized the importance of good international reputation, strong diplomatic networks, and multilateral cooperation." A book launch is taking place this evening at the University Bookshop at 5:30 p.m. Peter Grace and Robert Patman will join us in the studio for a live interview very shortly, so please stay tuned for our discussion.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday the 30th of May. Today's bulletin was written by Charlie Cunningham, Jonah Broughton and Jemima Lorimer and read to you by Charlie Cunningham and Jonah Broughton. And up next for you, we have Moon Power by Memory Foam. Welcome back to R1 News. We now have Professor Robert Patman and Dr. Peter Grace in to talk to us about their new book. Professor Robert Patman is a lecturer in the Politics Department specialising in international relations. His research interests include global security, American foreign policy, and of course, New Zealand foreign policy. He is a regular contributor to national and international media, sharing expertise on global affairs.
Dr. Peter Grace is a teaching fellow at the Politics Department, specialising in global security, New Zealand foreign policy, and international relations theory. According to a 2021 profile in Critic Te Arohi, Peter is known for his, quote, kind and soft-spoken demeanour, his dedication to his students, and a penchant for surreal row suits. Now, could either of you give us a quick pitch on your book?
Well, maybe I should start. Why don't I just say a few words about our motivation? I think, Peter, this book flowed from a meeting that we held at the Foreign Policy School, I think it was in 2021, during the COVID period, which is coming out of the COVID period. And we had been struck by several things. Firstly, that in the 21st century, great powers have struggled to deal with major problems, whether it be COVID-19 or even a range of security problems. And the second thing is that really, I think both Peter and I were conscious of, is that the Jacinda Ardern government was confronted by two very demanding problems. One was the terrorist atrocity of 2019 and then COVID-19. And in the process of being challenged in this way, we observed, and so did many other people, that New Zealand's international standing went up quite a lot, which I think alerted us to the possibility that perhaps as the 21st century unfolded, there would be more opportunities for a relatively small country like New Zealand to play a role in shaping ideas and contributing to problems which are too big to be solved by any one state, including superpowers. So I think that was part of the motivation for getting together an excellent team of scholars and diplomats to write their thoughts on various facets. But why don't I hand over to Peter?
Yeah, so it came out of the 21 Foreign Policy School, which you may know we've been running since 64, is that
64,
right?
66, actually.
66. So it has a long-standing history of meeting academics and practitioners together in one room. And this was very much that. We had quite an interesting range of people presenting, and it flowed into the book out of that. So the book's split into five parts. First of all, we look at setting the scene, how New Zealand had shaped up in previous years, and how this was a challenging moment for us. We looked about the promise and the possibilities that came out of COVID. We looked at the security scene and the foreign policy scene, and what it really was acknowledgement that we had a disrupted world, one that our government was having to demonstrate its competency in meeting. It's both the Christchurch terror attacks and in the COVID case. So it was a competency question first, and then it led on to, once we demonstrated to the world that we could do a good job, what opportunities did that open for us to demonstrate we could do better things with other issues like climate change, for instance. And of course, Jacinda Ardern was very famous and got world headlines for declaring a climate change emergency. So these big issues were out there and being debated. And Jacinda Ardern really had the limelight as a global leader at that time. Mm.
And how do you guys think the current government is performing in their foreign policy approach compared to Jacinda Ardern's?
It's probably a bit early to make a definitive judgment. I think foreign policy hasn't been necessarily top of the list of the national-led coalition. Having said that, there's two things that really stick out in terms of aspirations of this new government. Firstly, they want, I think, to have what they call a tighter alignment of traditional allies. This seems to be a reoccurring theme. And secondly, they want to be seen on the global stage as acting with more urgency. And I think that is a sort of reaction to the fact that during COVID, the international travel plans of the former Prime Minister, Nanaia Mahuta, were quite seriously disrupted. So I think, being a relatively small country, the government feels that it must, as to use Christopher Luxon's phrase, it must hustle on the international stage. It must be present. So I think the government's trying to do these two things. Whether it will succeed in fulfilling its aspirations, I think it's probably a bit early to say. I think we'll have a clear idea probably by the end of this year.
Yeah, I think that foreign policy is this wriggling beast that you have to grapple with. And one of the interesting things that comes out of the book is Jacinda Ardern and Nanaimo Hutta trying to grapple with our relationship with China. You know, Jacinda Ardern came from a politics and PR background. She did that as a degree at Waikato. She's a very accomplished as a communicator. And yet, when it came to China, there was a real struggle going on to say, why were we friends with China? You know, it's not really a Labour position to acknowledge a kind of partnership with a country that has human rights abuses, in particular, quite an oppressive government when it comes to democracy, those sorts of things. And you didn't want to shit in your nest, so to speak, but you also wanted to be quite clear that New Zealand had principles and we wanted to stick with them. And Jacinda's the speeches around that time, you've got the Taniwha and the Dragon with Nanaimo Hutta, and then followed by the mature relationship speech by Jacinda Ardern. There's a real struggle there to say, what is our relationship with China? And I think that the new government has the same struggle. Winston Peters, bless his heart, has a very brash way of putting things that seems to be calling a spade a spade. As Jacinda found, it's not easy to be frank about these things because no matter what you say, you're going to get bitten. And I think Winston will have the same problems. That would be my call.
Yeah, I mean, I just add to that, I think this government has changed in tone rather than substance. They've certainly been much more forward-leaning on something like AUKUS. The other government, they say that they're simply continuing the previous government's policy, but I think the big difference between the National Coalition's approach to Pillar 2 of AUKUS, the option from the previous Labour government, is that this government is linking Pillar 2 participation with tighter alignment with the United States and some of the traditional partners in AUKUS. But I'd like to reiterate what Peter said. You can set out your aspirations, but it's also there are quite striking continuities that both Jacinda Ardern described the relationship with China as one of the most complex but important, and Mr. Peters has said virtually exactly the same thing recently in a speech to the China Business Council in Wellington. So I think, in a sense, this new government is grappling with the realities. When you're in opposition, somebody once said, we can all be tigers out of office. But when you're actually dealing with the responsibilities of framing policy, and we're seeing this with respect to the AUKUS debate, the government has said it hasn't committed itself. And of course, it's very mindful there's a lot at stake. China is our biggest trade partner. And there's no easy replacement for the sort of market that China provides for much of our farming community, which is the backbone of this economy, our country's economy. So, yeah, I think Peter's absolutely right.
So obviously the book is an edited volume collecting perspectives from different scholars. Are there any chapters that sort of stood out to you as bringing a fresh perspective on Ardern's foreign policy?
Yes, there's quite a few. And they're coming from slightly different angles, which is part of its charm. So I think the first thing to acknowledge is this book is a snapshot in time. It's looking at a period around 2021 where New Zealand had this window of opportunity to make some big change on the world stage. We explore, first of all, why we had that opportunity. Philip Hill's written a fantastic article on our COVID response from a medical point of view, and then he weaves in how that affected foreign policy decisions. And then Bethan Greener from Massey has written an even better article in some ways about treating it as a national security crisis. And what about our national security mechanisms that kicked into place successfully. And we all know that, there was some wrangling that went on at the beginning of COVID, but the thing that New Zealand got so right was it made its mind up pretty quickly and then stuck by the rules. And you saw in Britain in particular this complete zigzagging of what we're doing now and what the rules are now, and then they changed the next week. So New Zealand was very consistent, and I think that's what the world admired. The other thing that we've done is we've got contributions, particularly from three I'd say, geopolitical experts. You've got Ford Hart, who was the American ambassador to the seven-party talks about North Korea. And Ford lived in Wellington for a few years in his retirement. So he brings a very American perspective on New Zealand's, some frustration from the American part that New Zealand wasn't working fast enough, possibly not acknowledging the American perspective as fast as they'd like. And then Ruben Steff and Nicholas Ross-Smith, who both have quite a IR theory type approach to the problem. Ruben in particular has almost a George Kennan-esque containment idea, which he calls strategic liberalism, which is sort of a baseball and a carrot held at the same time. And that's really quite fascinating to see somebody go into it and think about what the guiding philosophy of New Zealand might be moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I just echo what Peter said. But the other thing that struck both Peter and I, and I think Balash and Dennis, the other editors, is that what was remarkable about New Zealand's quite decisive response to COVID-19 was the fact that we didn't look to the United States, UK, or Australia, actually, initially. Our traditional partners, we looked to countries from Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea.
Now, this question's a bit more speculative, it doesn't matter if you don't have a definitive answer, but how would you guys think that Ardern would have handled the foreign policy challenges that New Zealand faces today, like Gaza and AUKUS?
A quick one. I think their policy would be different. I think Jacinda Ardern wasn't a foreign policy expert per se, but I think she had good political instincts. And if you saw her response to Ukraine, it steadily evolved and it hardened, much to the displeasure of the Russians. And I think Gaza, I think Jacinda Ardern had an empathy, and I think she would have identified with the victims of a disproportionate response to an act of terrorism.
I think also first principles is something that Helen Clark was always good at, and I think Jacinda Ardern understood instinctively. If you've done your homework and you start from the right place, you don't have to change your position every 5 minutes. And you constantly saw her going back to Michael Savage, going back to who was the Prime Minister?
Peter Fraser.
The guy that did the Otago, sent Otago to Mururoa.
No, you've lost me now.
Anyway, the other guy.
not David Longy.
No, I've lost him. Anyway, she went back to what previous people had done, and she said, we have a track record here of holding firm to our principles and keeping to them. Kirk was the guy I was thinking of.
Yeah.
And it meant that when it would come to Gaza, not so much with AUKUS, but certainly with Gaza, she would have gone in on principles first and she wouldn't have shifted. Whereas I see there's a bit of deliberation going on with the current government.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but thank you very much to both of you for coming on to talk to us. It was a fascinating conversation. Shame we couldn't chat for hours on end, but thanks very much. The book sounds really fascinating. And just a reminder that there is a book launch tonight at the University Bookshop at 5:30 p.m.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more at r1.co.nz or wherever quality content is found.